Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, it is, right? The 11th of July. This story has so many levels to it, and it keeps changing. The story we thought we were going to do last night has changed a little bit today, but it would appear that yesterday we were going to talk about lowering rates on federally subsidized student loans being out of the reach of Congress. At least it was yesterday, because the Senate failed to pass a bill that would reimpose a 3.4% fixed and subsidized rate on Stafford loans, the rate that, you know, collapsed and doubled on July 1st. Today, we get news that there may be a deal here, a bipartisan group of senators striking a deal late yesterday that would tie interest rates on new loans to the U.S. government cost to borrow, in a move that immediately reduces the cost to finance education. It is forecast to raise borrowing costs for millions of graduate students in about 3 years. We'll look at the details of that. It looks more likely that the Senate would pass that, but on this particular issue, they've had a hard time passing just about anything. So what's going on in the United States? And what prompted us to think about this issue beyond the United States? How are people financing education in other countries in the world? Is there a plan that's really good and we should emulate in some way? So we'll take that on the second part of this hour. Karen McCarthy is with us the first part of the hour, policy analyst for the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. Later, we will speak with Alex Usher, president of Higher Education Strategy Associates and editor-in-chief of Global Higher Education Strategy Monitor. We welcome phone calls all of this hour. You can talk about the various plans that various bipartisan group of senators, the Democratic plan, Senator Elizabeth Warren's concern about the cost of loans. Feel free to weigh in on all of this hour of the program, as well as your thoughts about what is a better way to finance college educations, keep yourself from having to have this huge debt. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Karen, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, sure. Thank you for having me.
Karen, there have been so many different plans that it's hard to keep track of all of them. Nothing passed yesterday, but today there is hope that there's going to be some kind of relief, but we don't know exactly what it is.
Yes, that does about sum it up. Yesterday, there was a vote on a plan that would revert the 6.8% subsidized loan interest rate for new loans back to 3.4%, which is what it was prior to July 1,
mm-hmm.
for one more year. And that plan was pushed by the Democratic leadership in the Senate. They really wanted to extend that 3.4% for one more year to allow enough time for more discussion to happen before the Higher Education Act is up for reauthorization, which is scheduled to happen next year. So their idea was to kick the can down the road for another year to allow more thoughtful discussion so that all of the details could be worked out and they could come up with a better plan in time for that reauthorization to happen.
Mm-hmm. And then there was a bipartisan group. They must have gotten together and had coffee or whatever last night, and they have another deal.
Yes. We have heard it was very late last night, so there are a lot of last-minute details still to be worked out, and there's a lot of information that we haven't seen yet. The most important bit of information that we haven't seen is how much this tentative deal will cost, what the scoring comes out to be from the Congressional Budget Office. That was scheduled to be released at some point today, and we have not seen it yet. So there are some people on the Hill who aren't really willing to say anything until that scoring comes down. So that mm-hmm. will be looked for with great anticipation. But the tentative deal would be a long-term solution that would set the interest rates to be what we call a variable fixed rate, which means that the rates would change every year. So they would be variable based on current market conditions. But once the student takes out that loan's rate will stay the same for the life of that loan.
I see.
The rates are variable, but once you take out the loan, then it's fixed.
Okay.
So we refer to that as variable fixed. So it is a positive development. NASFA is supportive of a long-term deal that would get the student loan interest rate to be based on market conditions rather than fixed rates that are set by Congress.
And
so there's a lot of details still to come, and we still don't know a lot of things as to whether, you know, if this tentative deal will actually move along. So
right.
We'll wait and see.
And tell me about the nature of these loans, Stafford loans. They're meant for, it's my understanding, moderate income and low income households. How many loans are there? And when you look at moderate low income households going to college, are we talking about half the people who have student loans have these loans, or less or more?
Well, the specific loans that were affected on July 1st that had the interest rates double from 3.4% to 6.8% are subsidized Stafford loans,
mm-hmm.
which means that they are need-based mm-hmm. Stafford loans. Not all Stafford loans are based on need. So these are the subsidized Stafford loans are the ones going to your low to middle income borrowers. There are about 8 million students each year that were affected when the interest rate went up from 3.4 to 6.8%. And it only affected new subsidized Stafford loans, which is important to note. So anybody who currently has a Stafford loan or is in repayment on a subsidized Stafford loan is not affected by this interest rate doubling at all.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, there's been some misinformation about that out in the media. So we don't want everybody to panic who happens to have a subsidized Stafford loan.
I see.
So there are about 8 million students. But an important point is that only 20% of student loan borrowers have only subsidized Stafford loans. So the remaining 80% of student loan borrowers are borrowing subsidized loans in addition to unsubsidized loans, or they're taking out parent loans.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why NASFA is supportive of a more variable rate that is based on market conditions is that it would apply to all of these types of loans. So it would help all of the loans be treated the same way as opposed to simply reverting back to 3.4% just for this subset of student loans.
Yeah. I don't know if you can assign blame here, but I'll ask you anyhow. If you can, you can. If you can't, you can't. But it does strike many as an indication of how partisan Congress is and how they're just not in touch with what everyday people are going through, that this could even have happened, that these rates could have doubled on July 1st. And you're talking about a group of people or middle income and low income. Anyhow, the people that everybody in Congress, be you Republican or Democrat, says you want to help. So what the heck went wrong?
I don't have a great answer for that. But what I can tell you is that prior to 2006, immediately prior to 2006, we did have variable interest rates. And in 2006, there was the College Cost Reduction and Access Act that gradually set fixed rates and gradually reduced them over the next few years to where to the 3.4%. And it was known back in 2006 when the College Cost Reduction and Access Act was passed that they would go from 3.4% back up to 6.8%. For the first time, this was scheduled to happen last year. So none of this is a surprise to anybody on the Hill. They knew that it was coming down the pike. And then last year, because it was the time of the election, everybody managed to come together July 1 of 2000, that would have been 2012, to extend that 3.4% to prevent it from doubling. At this point, this time around, it's not an election year, so the different parties are less likely to play nice with each other.
Mm.
And we ended up in this particular stalemate with different groups kind of digging their heels in on what we consider to be kind of minor parts of the different proposals that were out there.
And do you know, Karen, if indeed the profit from these student loans are being used, and somebody has recorded this as $51 billion, which is no small amount, to bring down the deficit? Is that true or not?
It's very complicated, and the answer to that question and whether student loans actually make money for the government or cost the government money really depends on who you ask and who's doing the different types of accounting. Because there are various ways of measuring the cost to the government. And so the Congressional Budget Office right now is legally obligated to calculate it in one way, but if they actually calculate it another way, then it turns out to be a complete flip-flop in terms of the making money, losing money proposition. And all of the budget math of that is somewhat beyond the expertise of what we do, because we at NASFA are not that concerned with how much money this costs to the government. We're really looking for good policy for our student loan borrowers. So kind of the answer to your question depends on, who you're talking to and which type of budget expert you're talking to.
So if you were designing a good policy for those who have to borrow, do you have a model?
The idea that we would really like to see is a long-term deal that would set the interest rates according to the current economic conditions in place. Ideally, we would like to see the neediest students receive the lowest interest rate, and then to have kind of the interest rates step up from there, so that your non-needy undergraduate students would step up a little bit, then your graduate students and your parent borrowers. But some of the details on what those amounts are, we don't have exact amounts in mind. We're mostly concerned that it be a long-term deal and that it be based on current market conditions, so that student loans rates are not based on the whims of Congress and that they really are based on something realistic that works in the real world.
Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest this part of the show is Karen McCarthy, policy analyst for the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. We're talking about student loans and the Stafford subsidized loans. As you know, because it was very much in the news, they had been at 3.4% the last few years before doubling to 6.8% on July 1st, affecting people from moderate and low-income households. And senators having a difficult time deciding what to do about this. So yesterday there was a vote and there was no action on anything. But last night, as Karen has said, it went very late last night. There was a bipartisan group of senators who struck a deal, and it looks as though this may happen, that ties interest rates on new loans to the U.S. government cost to borrow. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm sure there are some listening right now who have taken out some of these Stafford loans. What do you think is a fair policy? And why in the world is it that we had to wait until July 1st and the rate shoots up before there was serious attention paid to this, and then there's a vote and it doesn't go anywhere, so there's people talking to each other late last night to come up with something, because obviously the American people want this to be dealt with. What do you think? Phone lines are open for you. We will welcome your calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, student loans and Congress inaction yesterday, perhaps action soon on these subsidized loans, Stafford loans, and the interest rates. 800-486-8655 is our number. Mary is our first caller. Karen from Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was telling the lady who answered the phone that when I had graduated in 2001 from a private college, that there was one student, and I don't know her name, she had got a refund back from one of the loans a couple years before we graduated, and her relative told her, put that money or invest it in something. Anyways, by the time we graduated with our associate's degrees, she had enough money to pay off her loans. And I thought, why can't they share that with the rest of us? You know, that would be something great for everybody. So I know I am still stuck paying $40,000+ worth of student loans.
Ooh.
And I've yet to get a job in my field. I'm still a secretary, and I know with the stock market issues and all, I don't know if that's still, you know, something that we can do, invest our money and build it up so we could take care of those loans.
All right, we'll have our guest to answer that. How are you dealing with paying off your $40,000? Is a lot of money, Mary. How are you doing that?
Well, I'm back in school. It seems like I couldn't land a job in my field to save my life. So I said, well, accounting doesn't look too bad. Let me try that. So I'm going back to school for accounting. I probably will be one of those people affected by the loans increase, rate increase. But I'm hoping that our economy gets better. And maybe when I'm done, I'll get a, land a job in that field and I'll be okay, God willing.
Yeah, all the best to you. Karen, what do you say?
One thing, Mary, I'm not sure if you're aware or what type of repayment plan you're on, but the government does offer a repayment plan called income-based repayment.
Right, with- and I've been on that. And what I was told, because I, what I was paying is I was paying to, because now I have a bachelor's in business as well, and like I said, maybe it's my age, my height. I don't know. I just can't seem to land a position to get me to where I want to be. I'm, like I said, I'm still paying. I was paying to Sallie Mae, and I also paid to AES, who before I was paying ACS. I don't know if it's the same company, different name, but I was paying near 400 and something bucks, almost $500, and being a single parent, the only income in the house. You know, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that amount sounds really high to me if you were on income-based repayment at the time. You may want to double-check that with your lender. I know if you're back in school now, your loans are probably in deferment now. Is that right?
Yep, that is correct.
Okay. So once you finish school and you go back into repayments, you may want to check with your loan holders at that time because they can, there are also calculators online where you can enter in all of your information and decide based on what spits out in terms of, you know, what your monthly payment would be, how much, obviously lower monthly payments mean you're paying more in interest over the long haul. So it will
right,
do all of
right.
that math for you.
By the time that happens.
to help you pick an appropriate plan.
But I wasn't offered that. My question is this. Isn't there someone, and I guess you have to have good credit, of course, having to pay all these things. I don't have good credit. Isn't there a company or something that will take all those loans together from Sallie Mae and AES and put it in one big bill and say, okay, this is what you're going to pay us? You know, and give me a different interest rate if I don't already have a good one. I'd have to go back and look at everything. After a while, you just say, oh, whatever.
Is there such a thing?
Yes. Yes, that would be called a consolidation loan.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea behind a consolidation loan is to help people like you that have loans. It usually happens to people who go to school, leave school, and then go back to school. So they have different types of loan holders from different periods of time. And so what it does is it consolidates all of your loans into one giant loan, and then you just make one payment every month instead of more than one.
So where does she go to do that?
You can ask any of the loan holders that you have now, may be able to help you with that. And what they do when they calculate your interest rate is they come up with a weighted average. So you're just paying one interest rate. And then when you make your payment every month, they distribute it according to your loan, you know, your underlying loans according to your loan balances.
Mm-hmm.
But that is really helpful for people in terms of getting everything in one place and ease of paperwork and all of that.
Thank you, Mary, so much for your call. Margie in Menominee, hi.
Hello. I have a question regarding, I just want to clarify whether or not this is going to apply to older loans or if it's just for new loans, as they're talking about increasing. So our son has had loans for a number of years and has a huge loan, a huge number of loans that they have to pay off, he and his wife. And will those rates go up as well?
No. No, the rates that they're talking about setting now would be for new loans. So loans that have already been taken out, whether they were at lower rates or higher rates or whatever, those rates would not change.
Okay. That clarifies that. Thank you.
Thanks, sure. Margie. Thanks for the call. Carol in Madison, hi.
Hi. My question, I'm hoping your guest can comment about this. I think the bigger crime against students who are need to borrow is the extent to which for-profit colleges are basically making their surviving on student loans. And I think there was a change in the law that allowed student loans to be taken out for-profit colleges in the past. Maybe your guest knows more about that. But I see these colleges heavily promoted, and my understanding is that their degrees are not necessarily worth what people think they are, especially when they try to transfer credits. Could you ask your guest to comment on that, please?
Karen.
Sure. Yes, I can talk a little bit about the for-profits. There are probably in the last 10 to 15 years, there have been many more for-profit schools that are participating in the federal aid programs. So you see a lot more ads for the for-profits than you ever did in the past. There are many more of them than there ever were in the past. And as far as they do need to go through an eligibility certification process in order to be eligible to participate in the student loan program, so not all of them do. Those that do, as far as the quality of the programs that they're offering, they do have, the for-profit schools do have some special rules that apply to them in terms of the revenue that they're taking in and the source of that revenue. There have been in recent years several new rules that are primarily aimed at for-profit colleges to make sure that they are doing what they're supposed to be doing and they're offering quality education programs. Their students are actually graduating, they're getting jobs in their fields, and they're able to repay their loans. So there have been some changes in recent years. I don't think that those changes are done happening. So I do think that will still be in the news a little bit and different ways to make sure that educational programs are quality programs and the students are getting what they're paying for, basically.
Thank you, Carol, very much for the call. Karen, is there some kind of site we should go to so that we are up to date and on this pretty fluid situation?
Oh, you know, I don't even, you know, I would just keep, because this issue is such a big media issue lately, I have been seeing more and more articles just in the mainstream press.
Mm-hmm.
So I would, if this tentative deal that they reached last night actually becomes a reality and everybody agrees to it, then that will definitely be in the mainstream press. You'll see articles about that. Because that's a very big issue for today's students.
Yes, it is. Karen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Karen McCarthy, policy analyst for the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. We thought we would take a look at what's going on with financial aid and cost of college and being in debt in other countries. And Alex Usher knows all about other countries. He is president of Higher Education Strategy Associates and editor-in-chief of Global Higher Education Strategy Monitor. He's an internationally recognized expert in student financial aid and quality measurement in post-secondary education, has written many groundbreaking studies in higher education, and a special emphasis on higher education in Canada. His recent work spans Asia, Europe, and Africa as well. Welcoming phone calls for him. How do people pay for college and what are the cost differences when you look at other countries on this good earth? Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Alex Usher, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good.
So what's the most accessible, most affordable country in the whole world in which to go to college?
I always like to say, look, there's a bunch of different definitions of affordable, and there's a bunch of different definitions of accessible. When we talk about affordability, often you're just talking about sticker price, who's got the higher tuition, all that kind of stuff. But there's living costs come into it, and, mm-hmm. and living costs are very different for students in different parts of the world. And then there's the issue of, you know, what kind of student debt financial aid is available. And different people have different views about how to count grants and tax credits and loans and all the different kinds of methods that governments have to do this. Same with accessibility. I mean, there's lots of countries where people, accessibility isn't just how many people go, it's who gets to go.
Right.
And so there's a bunch of different dimensions of accessibility. That said, I would tend to say that the countries that do the best at both affordability and accessibility tend to be places like Finland.
Mm-hmm.
And Finland is good for a whole bunch of reasons, which are not just around financial aid or tuition. So they have a free tuition system, and they have a pretty good student aid system as well. Which isn't always true. Some countries that have free tuition actually have lousy student financial aid, and it's actually they're not very accessible. And that's true in, I would say, most of Central Europe. It is the right way to put that, is that they're free, but there's no money to help you live. It's very difficult to get a part-time job. And frankly, the systems aren't that big, so not that many people get to go to post-secondary in the first place. But, you know, the Scandinavian systems they're big, they're well-funded, and so I think they tend to take the top prizes on there. But there are other countries that have relatively high tuition fees, like Canada, which don't do too badly either. Canada, Australia, so those are countries that would have tuition fees that are, you know, not that different than what you'd see in the state system in Wisconsin, but with levels of access which are roughly the same as Finland.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me as though we all ought to be studying Finland. They seem to come up at the very top when it comes to public education, elementary and high school as well.
Yeah.
What is it that they are doing differently? How in the world can you make education, higher education, free to everybody?
How much money you want to spend on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
and how much money you want to tax. I don't think it's difficult. I mean, you know, the tax rates in Finland will be, you know, maybe twice what they are in the United States. So the government's got a lot of money to play with, and because
right.
they tax everybody so heavily, they're quite happy to make benefits available to everybody as well. And so it's, you know, tuition is free, as it is in a lot of Europe. The difference between Finland and most of the rest of Europe is, you know, in places like, Austria or, France, they tuition's free, but the government doesn't actually spend that much on higher education. The difference in Finland, they spend a heck of a lot. They're spending 2% of their gross domestic product on higher education, and it's free for everybody. They're talking now about charging foreign students for the first time, and this is this is a big deal in their parliament right now.
Mm-hmm.
If you're prepared to have the higher tax burden, it's not impossible to have those kind of regimes.
When you look at what's going on now, Alex, in the United States and the problems that Congress appears to have, the Senate particularly, in coming up with a plan, interest plan, rate actually for middle-income and lower-income students, is this a problem that other countries are facing or not?
No, I mean, I think the American system is a little odd right now. I mean, I'm not entirely sure why the interest rate is the main focus of attention. That kind of strikes me as a very weird way to go.
Hmm.
I think it's very well established in most countries that have student loans that you simply link students pay what the government pays to borrow.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty close to what the existing program is. That's not a particularly efficient way to go. I mean, there are lots of students out there. I mean, still in the United States, well over half of students don't have a problem paying their loans. I mean, there's a lot of people who do have problems paying loans, but so why not put your money just to help those that do, in a sense? And that was what when the Obama administration put forward its income-based repayment plan, the IBR, that's the right strategy. That gives the help directly to the people who really are low income and high debt, that mix there. Giving money to everybody is, it's less efficient, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I understand the politics behind it, but I think if you were going to the extent that you can help student loan borrowers by subsidizing people in the repayment phase, the IBR system, putting more money in the IBR system than in the, it makes a lot more sense than putting it on interest rates.
Mm-hmm. IBR?
Yeah, that's the income-based repayment that Obama put in 2009, I believe.
Okay. And let's focus a little bit more on the issue of accessibility, because the other thing that we're hearing is that there are a lot of people who simply can't afford with the interest rates and lack of availability of loans and family income that's not going up very much, that college seems to be out of the reach for a lot of low-income students in the United States. Is it even more out of the reach of students who have not been prepared to be college students? They've been on a different track in some countries in Europe or in other parts of the world?
Well, the U.S. system is actually unusually open to people from all backgrounds. I mean, I think one of the things that you see in a lot of the European systems is that they do, as I think you're alluding to, they track people out of university a long time before they're 18. You know, there's streaming systems for in most of Europe. So there's a lot of there's only, you know, maybe 50-60% of the population in a lot of those continental European countries that are even eligible for university when they finish their secondary school. On the other hand, those countries are also a little bit better at finding pathways for people who haven't quite got their high school together to then take that and go into college. And that's obviously been a big issue in the United States as well. I think that the preparation for college is a big issue. I mean, I think you do see certain countries where the level of preparation for university is good. And I don't think the money issue is ever really an issue on its own, right? It's much more of an issue when it's combined with other issues. It's not just I can't get the money together to go to school. It's because that's usually not what it is. It's usually, wow, this is a risk, right? I've got this money and I don't know if college is the right thing to do because I'm worried about the job market. I'm worried there's not a job for me at the end. So certainly when countries go through periods of high youth unemployment, that problem gets worse. But, you know, it's that risk issue. And the safety net isn't very good in the United States, and at least until the without the income-based repayment program that you had. I mean, the U.S. safety net was really bad compared to other countries. Other countries had much better ways of sort of saying to students, look, if you come out and you're making $20,000, $25,000, maybe even $30,000, you don't have to pay the full amount of your student loan, right? That's the kind of program that I think the safety net programs that are probably, you know, efficient. If you're making 40, 50, go ahead. You know, you can pay your loan. That's not a big deal. If you're making 25, 30, if you're, you know, going from part-time job to part-time job, juggling two or three of them at the same time, that's a problem. And so I think that those issues are a big deal. But if you think about it from the perspective of someone who's 18, 19, do I go or not? Periods of high unemployment increase the risk, and that makes people not want to go quite as much. The other thing is do I feel prepared to go? If I go, will I succeed? And the United States has got really, really high dropout rates compared to most other countries. And I think that has something to do with the secondary school system.
Oh, that's interesting. So what's the difference?
And so part of what's going on there is it's not just that people say, I don't think I can afford college. It's do I even want to put any money down if I don't know I'm going to finish?
Uh-huh.
Right? And that's a much bigger risk. I mean, in Canada, you know, 90% of the people who go into four-year colleges have either got a degree or are still in the system after 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in the U.S., you know, the numbers aren't quite, you don't have a unit record system that allows you to track people quite the way we do. But, you know, best guess is, you know, 60, 65.
Oh, what a difference. Yeah.
But it's a big difference. And that's the real issue in the States, right? It's a different kind of, risk proposition.
Mm-hmm.
My point of view has always been the U.S. universities do a pretty good job considering what they're given. You know, there are obviously there's lots of great secondary school systems in the United States, but, you know, there are pockets, particularly in urban areas, where it just doesn't seem to be working.
Right.
Well. And that's reflected in the kinds of high dropout rates that you see, particularly in inner city community colleges. I mean, some of which are mind boggling.
Mm-hmm.
At some point you got to start pointing fingers at the secondary school system. Which itself is an issue, how you fund education, and it's about class and race and all the rest of it. But,
right.
You know.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. It's a big issue.
Yeah, a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. We have been hearing, certainly, that in the United States it's become absolutely necessary if you're going to get a job that pays, you know, anything, you have to have a college education, even with the fact that jobs have gone overseas, et cetera, it makes it even more important. Is that kind of a worldwide thing, or is that peculiar to the West in some way? Is it true that college is becoming mandatory all over the world, Alex?
It's certainly true that demand for college education is going up absolutely everywhere in the world. That's a difficult question to answer because at a certain level it ceases to be about whether or not a job, you know, objectively requires an education and whether or not enough people in the country or in a region or in a city have education that it becomes the automatic filtering mechanism, right? So, you know, if jobs are scarce and employers just want to figure out, well, who am I going to give this job to, they may simply say, well, that guy's got a degree and, you know, she's got a degree and he doesn't. But, you know, if that's front desk at a hotel or something like mm-hmm. that, right, that's mm-hmm. not a job that needs university. But, in fact, in practice, sometimes it does because it's the easiest filter people have. So, in a sense, supply creates its own demand after a certain point. It's difficult to be objective about that question because, education is to a certain degree an arms race, right? A degree is a positional good. It's good to the extent that I have it and somebody else doesn't, right? That it gives me an advantage in the labor market.
Right.
Once you get to a point where a certain number of people have it, it becomes the new minimum.
Mm.
The equation changes a bit.
We welcome phone calls. If you'd like to join our conversation, we would love to hear from you. Alex Usher is our guest this part of the show, president of Higher Education Strategy Associates, editor-in-chief of Global Higher Education Strategy Monitor. All of this discussion about how to pay for loans and what the interest rate should be for middle-income and lower-income students who are getting federally subsidized loans in the United States got us thinking about other countries. Well, what do they do in other countries? If people need to take loans, and do they in most countries? How are the rates set? Are they similar to the United States rates? And what about the value of a college education and how you are prepared for college in various parts of the world? Who's on top of all of this with free tuition? Finland. They're ranking pretty high when it comes to all levels of education, aren't they? I'm sure there are some of you listening who have been educated in other countries, too. How would you compare the American experience with the French experience, or the Japanese, or Saudi Arabia, or wherever? We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Monday at this time, I'll be talking to world-renowned British neurologist Oliver Sacks. He turned 80 years old on July 9, and he wrote a fascinating piece for the New York Times, The Joy of Old Age, parentheses, no kidding. Oliver Sacks, Monday at 2 o'clock. We welcome phone calls for our guest as we look at cost of education, how people pay for it, students in countries all over the world. Alex Usher is our guest, president of Higher Education Strategy Associates, editor-in-chief of Global Higher Education Strategy Monitor, 800-486-8655. Nick is our first caller for you, Alex, from Madison. Hi, Nick.
Well, this couldn't be a more timely topic. My son just left early this morning for orientation to go to college in Milwaukee, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Oh.
I am a physical therapist. I thought I made a pretty good amount of money, and I guess they think I make a lot of money. He's only being offered $5,000 in interest loans. That's it for the whole year. My oldest daughter's at UW-Madison pre-med. I have another daughter coming up in a year, and she'll be wanting to go to college.
Oh.
I don't think responsibly I can encourage my son to take on this, $80,000 loan? He wants to be a physician assistant. That's 30 slots for 600 applicants. I don't even know what to tell him. I'm trying to talk him out of it. I'm trying to say, go to MATC, take the basic courses, but he wants to go to college.
Hmm.
What is the answer? What do I tell this kid?
Okay, Alex, what does he say?
The obvious thing is the kind of debt load that you want to take on, you want to ask a child to take on, generally speaking, shouldn't be more than a year's worth of salary when they come out. More than that, and they're going to be in real trouble real quick. Now, again, the things like these new programs like income-based repayment will help a little bit, but you got to be very, very careful about letting the debt level go too far. I think over 30. Now, there's ways to cut that down, right? I mean, you can go to work for a year, you can work part-time during the year, you contribute. There's all those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, if you're coming out with more than a year's worth of salary in terms of debt, you're going to have a problem. So that's a good rule of thumb, I would say.
What about his idea? There's a technical system that's fairly strong in the state of Wisconsin and in some other states. Does it behoove young students who want to go into medical-related fields to look if they can go to technical colleges to pick up some of those courses and then go on to a different college and pick up different kinds of courses? Is it less expensive?
It's certainly less expensive. It's probably leading to less remunerative jobs at the end of the usually, anyway, not always. So, you know, it's something to explore for sure. But it may make, you know, if in fact, you know, the son is dead set on a medical career that requires something else, then often you're just adding 2 years to the process. So, you know, it's certainly, if you're not sure what you want to do and you want to try a few things out, it's a great way to do it. But you know, if you really do have your heart set on something bigger and it is possible to do with a little bit of extra work and a reasonable amount of debt, I'm not sure I'd take that route.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Nick, for your call. Good luck to your son, John in Broadhead. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say, too, I agree with everything that he just said, of course, but I'd like to say, too, that, you know, if you can't afford it, I mean, don't do it. You know, it's one of them things where, you know, if you're a doctor's son, your dad wants you to go in and be a doctor, you know, you can afford that. You can pay that kind of money. Not a problem. But, you know, if you're maybe like I am, you know, my son, I cannot afford to give him education like that. And if he wants to, I will support him 100%. I know people that their parents gives them their whole, you know, basically retirement so that they can go through college.
Right.
And then they end up not doing anything but working in a fast food restaurant.
Hmm.
And I guess that's all I need to say. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thanks, John. Alex, what do you say?
Yeah, I'm not sure what you can say to that. I mean, other than, you know, a lot of the issue about whether, you know, how people do on the way out, in part has to do with how they spend their school years. I think, there is the expectation that you have a kind of a 1950s or 1960s kind of collegiate life that, you know, that, the extensive participation in sororities or fraternities, those kinds of things. I mean, that can be a real cash drain. So certainly, I think, and there's a very good book out about this called "Paying for the Party," which was out just a couple months ago in the U.S. and it was an unnamed Midwestern school. Actually, it was a couple
"Paying for the
sort
Party."
Of fall to floor. Yeah, it's a fantastic book.
Mm.
And it really did show that there, you know, sort of the middle class kids who get sort of caught up in that fairly expensive and fairly time consuming party scene, basically on campus, they often don't end up with the set of skills and grades that they need to go on and succeed in life, or if they want to go to grad school or those kinds of things. And for those students, they really do lose their money.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, if you're doing something like, you know, mortgaging your house to get that money, or you're dipping into your retirement funds, I mean, you know, that's a real problem. It's the kids who are able to stick to the books and spend a little bit of time exploring the world of work, right? To be able to do a little bit of work while you're in school, that's a good thing, right? Because you get
sure
to understand your needs and your strengths and you know, the possibilities for career a little better. That's the you know, I think you have to be able to stick to the straight and narrow. And so there's a certain amount of personal responsibility you have to ask of your kids if you're putting up the funds for it.
Right, absolutely. Thanks, John, very much for the call. Let's switch for a moment. I know you do these every couple of years because it's a big thing to do, but I was looking at your report on global tuition fee showing university tuition fees around the world. And it's interesting here because in tuition in a couple countries, the United States, South Africa, up 5% over and above inflation 2011, but there are other countries where it's down 5%. So how did that happen?
Well, it depends on the country. There's a lot of countries around the world that are how can I put this? They're not quite, they're past the development stage, but they're only recently developed. So places like Chile and South Korea in particular, you see examples of countries that, if, you know, they've never spent any money on higher education to develop. In fact, that's one of the reasons they developed so quickly, was they didn't tax people. They didn't, you know, they said, if you want education, get it privately. And that's what they did. And so you're starting to see a big backlash in some of those countries in Latin America, in Asia, where people are saying, okay, you know what, we've made it, we've got this rich, you know, richer society now. You know what, we'd like to have some goods purchased collectively. And so that's why you're seeing all these, you know, the prospective president of the Chile, Michelle Bachelet, she's just made a promise to reduce tuition fees at universities there. In the presidential election in South Korea in 2012, obviously everybody's promising to reduce tuition fees by half. So, you know, I mean, there are places where the pendulum is swinging the other way. I mean, I think what you're seeing is, globally, people are starting to, they're kind of meeting in the middle, so that a lot of the zero tuition countries are putting fees on in various different ways, and some of the very high tuition countries are starting to come down. And I think what you're seeing is people are proud, you're going to see a kind of a global standard where, yeah, it's normal that students pay 25-30% of the freight, maybe 40% of the freight, but not that they should be paying 60-80%, as is the case in some places, and they should be paying zero, as is the case in other places. I think globally that's the kind of standard we're heading to.
And what about, I don't know if you keep track of students going to other countries to do their studies. Has there been a lot of that? Has been some for medical procedures, people are going to parts of the world where it doesn't cost as much.
Oh, no. Most of the international trade and students, it's students going to places where it's much more expensive.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And partly because, you know, just like in the U.S., you know, people equate tuition with prestige. But, you know, it's, so, you know, Saudi Arabia's got 150,000 students a year leaving the country now.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's very explicit. That's the king thinking he needs to get the kids away from some of the mullahs, basically. He'd like more of them to have an experience abroad. And in places like China, you're looking in India, you're talking about 500,000 or even more students a year going abroad. Some of those students are going abroad because they want to get skills, because there's prestige to going to an American school or a European school. There's certainly some prestige to getting it in English. Others are going for, you know, in a sense as a form of emigration. So here in, you know, just in Toronto, we must have almost 30,000 international students in our universities and colleges. And a lot of them are from India, and a lot of them are not expecting to go back, right? I mean, so that is one, that's a big difference in Canada. The U.S. is a lot of the international students that we get. We're very definitely going to take them as immigrants at some point. We're pretty clear about that in some provinces. So Manitoba, for instance, is just north of you. If you're a foreign student and you finish a degree, you're automatically enrolled in what's called the provincial nominee program, which means the province is vouching for you to the federal government, saying this person should be a citizen.
Oh, interesting.
So that's a different kind of thing.
Right.
But people are going to the more prestigious and hence more expensive institutions generally. It's not like you're shopping for the cheap surgery.
One more call. Need to do it quickly. Almost out of time. Mike in Eau Claire.
Hello?
Yeah, Mike. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, this hits pretty close to home. My daughter went to Stout and graduated in 2008, right when the economy busted. And she graduated with honors in her class and actually could not find a job in her field until just recently, where she's making $13 an hour and has no way at all of paying her loans back. Now, what does a caller know about, like, I've heard of this, the Australian plan of paying back?
All right. Yeah, I think you've written about that, haven't you? In 45 seconds, please.
The Australian system, you're not paying anything back. It's very much like the U.S. in the sense that there's a level belief beneath which you don't need to repay your student loans, and they call it deferment or forbearance in the U.S. And in Australia, it's simply you don't pay anything back on your loan until you're making about $40,000, and then they simply take a portion of your income off your salary every 2 weeks at work. So it's a tax-based recovery system, and that's available there. It's available in the UK. It's available in New Zealand. So it's a form of what they call income contingent loans. And America does have various types of income contingent mechanisms, including the income-based repayment program I was mentioning earlier. So there is some relief in the U.S. for those kinds of things. It's not quite as generous as it is in other countries.
Yeah. Well, Alex, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Alex Usher, President of Higher Education Strategy Associates, Editor-in-Chief of Global Higher Education Strategy Monitor, looking at how students pay for going to college in other countries in the world, and if they're taking out loans, is there a way they've figured out to do that? And there's not as much debate about it as there has been in the United States. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and K.P. Whaley, who produced this program. We'll be with you again on Monday, All Things Political at 1. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.